I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're going to be taking a look at what we know about possible coordination between the Russian government and Donald Trump's campaign. We will look at the revelations from Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Kremlin-linked lawyer, and now we've discovered there was another person in the room over the weekend. We'll find out who that person was. The president's relationship and comments about Vladimir Putin. We will discuss whether or not this was a big deal to have this meeting, and this interesting comment by Donald Trump's lawyer that, you know, if this had been a big deal, the Secret Service would not have let these people into the room. We'll look at other members of the campaign and their meetings with various Russian people and why those happened and who had meetings and what the American public thinks about this. We have as our guest this hour Yochi Drezin. He is the foreign editor at Vox. He has in the past worked for Foreign Policy magazine and also for the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War, the story of a military family who lost two sons, one to suicide and one to combat, and channeled their grief into fighting the military's suicide epidemic. Yochi has spent some 5 years and many, many trips, 30 trips, I think, to both Afghanistan and Iraq, and spent 5 years on the ground in those two countries. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we cover this Russia story with Yochi as our guide. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Yochi Drezin, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Hi, my pleasure.
You have said that if Donald Trump, the president, knew of the collusion with Russia, this scandal would be bigger than Watergate. Do you think that there is a chance that he did know about this?
I do. I think there's a chance, although if I had to bet on it, I would bet that he didn't. I think what we've learned about Donald Trump during the campaign and since is that this is not a man who very much cares for details. He's not a man who very much cares for nuance or for really understanding what's going on beneath him. He's focused always on just the win in kind of a macro sense. And what I suspect was happening here was, and bear in mind also, his campaign was tiny. So you have a dozen or two dozen people who are close to him as compared to many hundreds who are involved in the Clinton campaign. I suspect that this meeting happened, he doesn't pay close enough attention to what his son was doing, what Jared Kushner was doing, what Paul Manafort was doing, to know. And I suspect they just did it without bothering to tell him.
What about after the meeting? You think they'd had a discussion about it? It seems to be a fairly significant meeting, doesn't it?
It does. And the question in my mind is less, did they tell him about this particular meeting, and more, did they tell him that Russia was trying to help? I mean, in some ways, like, that's really the big question.
I see.
You know, did that? I think big question one is, did Trump collude, which is huge. But I think if you give him the benefit of the doubt and say that he did not himself collude, there's a question of knowledge. You know, was he even aware that this was all happening? Was he even aware that Russia was trying to help him? And you've seen since the election, he gets so furious whenever that's raised and so openly rejects what the CIA believes and the FBI believes and what the entire intelligence community believes, because he sees that as an attempt to sort of delegitimize his presidency and say that he only won because Russia helped. But I think there is this interesting question of dating back to the summer of 2016, so well before he won the election, well before he was inaugurated, did he then, in that moment of time, know Russia was trying to help, or was he unaware of that conclusion until after the election?
Do you think that Robert Mueller, however long it takes, and it may like take a long time, will give us a very complete and thorough report that he'll get to the bottom of all of this?
Well, presuming, one, that he isn't fired, which is...
You think he might be?
I do.
Really?
I don't think it's a likelihood, but Trump has talked pretty openly. He's kind of mused openly about doing so, as have people close to him, like Newt Gingrich and Chris Ruddy, who's one of his best friends and often speaks for him publicly. They've begun to lay the groundwork by saying that Mueller's team is made up of people who had donated to Hillary Clinton, and therefore, blah, blah, blah. You know, you could see the argument they're making. Therefore, he's a Democrat, or he's a Democrat in hiding, and it's all partisan, and it's all made up. I think it'd be very difficult for him to do, because the controversy and the talk of impeachment that exists now would ratchet up a millionfold if he then fired Bob Mueller after firing James Comey. But it is worth remembering that the difference between what Bob Mueller is doing and what the various committees in the House and the Senate are doing is that in Congress, whatever they find will eventually be made public. Bob Mueller, whatever he finds, won't. I mean, he's building a criminal case. He's not building a report for public release. So what he finds will then get kicked up as they make a decision on whether to prosecute and then go to a grand jury. And so it's worth remembering that what he finds may never be made public in its entirety.
Well, when are we going to hear from Donald Trump Jr.? Is he going to be subpoenaed by the House or the Senate committees? And are they functioning now? We haven't heard anything about him in a few weeks.
It sort of goes up and it goes down. You know, one week it's the House is functioning and the Senate's not. The next week the Senate's functioning and the House is not. And it is very hard to get a sense of exactly where things stand. There's been talk that they will issue that he's been invited to testify. It's the kind of gentle way they're referring to it now.
Mm-hmm.
They're not yet saying they'll subpoena him to testify. They've hinted that they will, but they actually, as with so much with the Republicans on the Hill, they haven't shown much backbone as of yet. So in terms of saying they want him to testify, yes. In terms of saying they really want him to testify, pretty please, yes. But in terms of saying they'll try to force him to if he refuses, no one has gone that far just yet.
So Donald Trump Jr. took a meeting with a Kremlin-linked envoy, as you write, who explicitly promised information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia, and those meetings could be very useful to his father. The information was very high level and sensitive. We now found out over the weekend that there was somebody else, it was not disclosed who this person was, who seems to have had doing something in the Russian war in Afghanistan with some kind of cybersecurity analyst. Some have called him a spy. Some have called him Russian intelligence. How important was that addition? Who is that guy? And what about this meeting that was taken? Is it something that, as Donald Trump has suggested, the president, well, this is just politics. Anybody would do this.
I think if you want to give the most benign possible, and I think it's not totally irrational thing to believe, you would say Donald Trump Jr. is new to politics. He's never done this before. He's told, hey, we have stuff that could help your father in his election. So he says, sure, let me see what you have, and doesn't really give it a moment's thought as to whether that's ethical, legal, etc. It's a harder argument to make, given that we know Jared Kushner was also involved in this, and that we also know Paul Manafort, who had been around forever and certainly knows what's appropriate and what's not, was also involved. And it's also a harder argument to make because they lied about it. Donald Trump Jr. Right. lied about it repeatedly. Jared Kushner lied about it repeatedly. So it's really hard to square the lies and the deceptions with the kind of the sort of benign explanation Trump Sr. is trying to give, which is, hey, this is just politics, not a big deal. But it is a big deal. And in some ways, what's most jarring to me is the Trump response, which wasn't, yeah, this sounds really good, let me just ask my lawyers, let me just ask someone, let me hold on, let's take a deep breath, let me figure out if I can do this. But it was the immediate response. If you look at the timestamp, it was almost an immediate response, and it was the, I love it. I mean, this sort of passionate, right, enthusiastic embrace. And that's, I think, what's really jarring to a lot of people from both parties, frankly, who look at this, is that there was no hesitation. There wasn't even a minute's doubt about Russia, a hostile foreign power, trying to help, and him just saying, give me everything you have.
Mm-hmm. What about the president's lawyer saying if there was something nefarious going on here with this meeting, the Secret Service would have stopped these people from going? Does that mean would have stopped them when they got into Trump Tower? Or because Donald, my understanding is that Donald Trump Jr. did not have Secret Service protection at that point.
So it's really in the kind of escalating cascade of absurdity that is mixed in with the escalating cascade of lies that's around this. This is in some ways the most absurd argument. They're saying that the Secret Service, as you said, didn't let him in, and therefore how bad could it be? There are two problems with that, and they're both pretty significant. One, the Secret Service wasn't vetting anybody at that point for Donald Trump Jr. So it's just a lie. I mean, it's just a flat lie to say the Secret Service was somehow involved in deciding who saw Donald Trump Jr. They cleared this, therefore it's no big deal. They were not involved in deciding who saw Donald Trump Jr., so that's just a lie. Then, secondarily, even if they had been involved in deciding who would see Donald Trump Jr., all they're looking for is whether it's a safety risk. The only question they have is this person going to come into the Trump Tower and try to stab Donald Trump Jr. to death with a pen? Are they a security threat? They're not asking, okay, what is this person going to talk about? Show me every email this person has ever sent. Show me everything from their resume about what it is they might want to talk to. So if the Secret Service were protecting Donald Trump Jr. at the time, which again, they were not, they would have some background investigation, mildly, into who the person was. But then once they discover this is a lawyer with a long background as a lawyer, it's not as if they were then going to say, okay, lawyer, Are you talking about collusion?
Well, some are saying that the reason that he mentioned the Secret Service was by mistake, which was an indication that the president may have been in the room and the Secret Service did have to check people. Is there anything to that, do you think?
No, I think that that's in the same way that there's an enormous amount of right-wing nuttiness around this. There's a little bit of nuttiness around this on the progressive left, and I would put that into that category.
Okay. Why is it that President Trump has repeatedly rejected the U.S. intelligence community's unanimous belief that Russia interfered in our election?
Because he believes that if you accept that as true, that then means people will say he won because of Russian help. You know, as we know, he's already hypersensitive to the fact that he lost the popular vote. He talks about it again and again and again and again. And he's also somebody who lies again and again and again about the size of his electoral vote. He keeps saying it was one of the biggest in history when, in fact, it was the smallest or one of the smallest in modern history. So it's the reverse of what he says. So we know that he's prone to lying about his electoral college victory and that he has this deep, deep, deep sensitivity about his loss in the popular vote. So in his worldview and the worldview of his supporters, this is all made up by Democrats who are angry that they lost, and that the whole purpose of this coming out is to try to make him look weak and make him look illegitimate, and therefore he has to fight it and go full bore and try to push back what they say. And it's a harder argument to make when the people who are doing the investigation aren't Democrats. I mean, if Democrats controlled Capitol Hill, okay, maybe you could plausibly say it's just angry Democrats in the House and the Senate whose presidential candidate lost, so they're using the powers they have running the House and the Senate. The problem, of course, is they don't run the House or the Senate. So the investigations are being led by Republicans. Comey was a Republican. Bob Mueller was a Republican. And so this idea that this is just a partisan witch hunt, which is the verbatim phrase Trump uses all the time, is belied by the fact that the people leading it are all Republicans.
Mm-hmm. And do people believe that it's a witch hunt and also that all we're getting is fake news on all of this? We hear those words over and over and over again. Is that enough for the people who are fervent Trump supporters to not waver in their support of him and not be troubled by this story?
It is, unfortunately. And we saw this in two ways, one specific to Vox and one more kind of beyond Vox and what we do. Specific to Vox, a reporter colleague of mine who works for me named Lindsay Maisland last week went back to the small town of Michigan where she grew up, which had voted pretty heavily for Trump, and spent the day asking people she knew, you know, neighbors and friends and family friends, about this scandal and whether they believed it, whether they thought there was anything to it. And almost universally, the answer was no.
Really?
The most she would hear back was, yeah, there's probably something there, but Democrats are complaining. So there were some people who acknowledged something in it was not great, but even those people couched it in, it's not as big of a deal as Democrats say. But the bulk of the people she spoke to just said, no, there's nothing here. It's all made up by the media. It's all made up by the deep state. So they were all completely buying the Trump argument. The other one, which was polling data and a statistical point, the Washington Post released a gigantic poll today on Trump's approval ratings, which have plummeted.
Right.
And in it was a really striking number, which was that over the course of the last month, the percentage of Republicans, of Trump supporters, excuse me, so Republicans who voted for Trump, who believe this is made up, doubled. So, I mean, really think about that. So in the month where the evidence of this became more concrete than ever before,
fascinating.
At the same time, double the number of people who thought this was fake now think of it as fake.
Which means that, what, they're just reading Breitbart and watching Fox News and not taking in any other information? Or what is that? Because there's some truth to all of this. You would want people to be able to see the truth.
I think that there is a strong sense that the media intake that they're taking in and sort of the information that they're gathering is coming exclusively from right-wing sites. So whether it's Breitbart, whether it's InfoWars, whether it's Fox News, you know, the reach that Republican-leaning and conservative media have towards their voters, the connections those media organizations have with their voters is exponentially stronger than anything that exists on the left. And I think that what you're seeing in some ways is the culmination, and for Donald Trump, it's a very beneficial culmination, but for 30 years, Republicans have been saying the media is biased, the media is biased, the media is biased. And for 30 years, they've been trying to say the media can't be trusted. And when you've said that for 30 years, at some point, that really begins to sink in. And it's now sunk in for roughly 35% of the country who are still right with Donald Trump. They believe everything that's being reported by someplace other than Fox News is a lie.
Hmm. And yet you've had some prominent conservatives. We had somebody on Fox News over the weekend. I'm sure many in our audience saw this. Shepard Smith, who had what some are calling a Cronkite moment. Why is there lie after lie? My grandmother used to say, oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. And he got quite animated. Charles Krauthammer said the Russia scandal has entered a new phase and there's no going back. So you have some prominent people on either conservative stations like Fox or very prominent conservatives who are concerned about this. Does that make a difference?
No, because the people that are talking about this for the most part are the ones who've talked about it before, and they were ineffectual before in changing kind of Republican opinion, and there's very little reason to think that that will suddenly change. You know, Shep Smith is a very good journalist, a very talented journalist. I wouldn't put him into the category of conservative, frankly, but his reach is not that of Sean Hannity.
Right.
His reach is not that of the people at InfoWars, and the people at InfoWars, Sean Hannity, they are 100% in the camp of this is all fabricated, Trump Jr. did nothing wrong, Donald Trump did nothing wrong. And so if you have one voice on Fox News saying he did, and who's well-regarded but isn't one of their biggest stars, but all their biggest stars kind of parroting the other line, it's not clear what, if anything, Shep Smith would do. In the case of Krauthammer, he's somebody who was very publicly opposed Trump during the nomination process and during the campaign. Trump insulted him very personally on Twitter. So this is not someone who has ever been really moving Republican public opinion. You know, this is someone who hates Donald Trump, has made clear he hates Donald Trump, and that had zero impact on the election.
The New York Times editorial yesterday was concerning all of this, and let me quote what they said. I'm interested in your response. Trump is noticeably more comfortable with Mr. Putin than with most of America's Democratic allies. Despite Putin's record of crushing domestic opponents, invading Ukraine, and bombing civilians in Syria. Is that a fair assessment of Mr. Trump and his relationship with Putin? And if so, why is he more comfortable with Mr. Putin?
So I think that it is a fair assessment. And it's not just Putin. You can go further. You could say that his relationship with the dictators running Egypt, Turkey, these are much stronger in most cases than his relationships with the leaders who are democratically elected, who are running France, Germany, England. And there's a lot of psychoanalysis as to why that is. I think that the easiest answer, the sort of Occam's razor answer, is Trump thinks of himself as a tough guy, thinks of himself as a tough guy who's being constrained, like was the case in, you know, like a Lilliputian, being constrained by the meddlesome media and the sort of meddlesome Congress and the meddlesome courts. And then he looks around the world and says, okay, who are the tough guys? And this is Vladimir Putin. And Putin has no media to worry about, and he has no judges to worry about, and he has no Congress to worry about. Same in Turkey, same in Egypt. And I think there's a bit of believing himself and wanting himself to be seen as a tough guy, and then a sort of aspirational, like, if only I had rid myself of these things the way that those guys had, I'd be just as tough as they are. And it all kind of feeds itself, right? Like, if you're Donald Trump and you believe that much of the country doesn't like you, which is true, and distrusts you, which is also true, and questions whether you won the election fairly, which is also true. So because of that, you build up this shell where any questioning of any interference means people are doubting your legitimacy, and therefore you'll push back at it 100%. When you have that kind of mindset and you have that wall built around yourself and that kind of bunker mentality, I could see how you would then look to somebody like Putin, who is strong and effective and who has made his country feared on the world stage, and want to model yourself, after Putin. And that's what he's trying to do, just with no success.
Mm. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Yoki Driesen is our guest. He is foreign editor at Vox. He's also worked for Foreign Policy and the Wall Street Journal. The author of The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War. He spent 5 years on the ground in Afghanistan and Iraq, has made 30 trips to those two countries. And we're talking about Russia and the Trump administration this hour. Welcoming your phone calls, here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Lines are open for you right now, and we'll go to you in a moment after we pause for a moment on the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls for Yoki. And Nell in Madison is first. Hi, Nell.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Did I hear that you are retiring?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I am so sorry. I'm glad for you, but I will greatly miss you.
Thank you, Nell.
I hope someone comes in here. Two things. I wanted to give my corroboration as a layman of your guest's assertion that Mr. Trump's claim that the Secret Service would have prevented anything illegal is not only nonsense but a lie. The Secret Service has absolutely no authority to decide whether someone's purposes coming in to a secured person are legal beyond the security of the life and limb of that person. The other thing is I wanted to ask him a question, and just what is his sense in the broadest and subjective terms, but with his objectivity, if he thinks that the constitutional democracy of the United States is in serious jeopardy at this point in our history. I believe it is. I believe we're at the worst jeopardy we've ever been in since the Civil War. And I'll take my answer off the line.
Thank you.
And good luck to you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Wish you all
the
best.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Yuki.
That's a hell of a question. I mean, it's...
Yes, it is.
That sort of...
That we're even asking it is amazing.
Exactly. I mean, I think the fact that the question is even being asked is a bit of an answer to itself. I don't think that we're at this kind of dystopian moment where the next step is going to be the fall of American democracy and the rise of the Handmaid's Tale or sort of some kind of fascist totalitarian state. I do think that we're at a moment where the institutions of American democracy are being tested. So far, they've held. I mean, the media is being more aggressive in its watchdog role than at any point in my adult lifetime. The courts have constrained Donald Trump again and again and again. Congress has yet to step up, but has also not rolled over completely. There are places like on the Obamacare repeal where Congress is pushing back too. So I don't think that this is the biggest constitutional crisis moment ever. I don't think this is the moment that's weakened our country like nothing before. I don't think we've hit Watergate yet. But I do think that if Donald Trump were to fire Bob Mueller, and which would mean firing enormous numbers of Justice Department officials till he found someone willing to fire Bob Mueller. But if Trump did that, and if Trump ignored, let's say, the Supreme Court ruling against him on the Emoluments Clause, and the Supreme Court said you're illegally profiting from your buildings, you have to sell them, and he refuses to do it, and sort of basically dares Republicans on the Hill to impeach him, if we get to that point, then I think you could begin to seriously say we're at a historic low point for the country. But we're not there yet.
You know what I'm worried about, so you can allay my fears, and I'm sure others have this worry. I ask this question over and over again. The gentleman who wrote a book about elections and problems with elections, eminent scholar from one of the UC schools, has said this, that by 2020, cyber attacks could try to alter or erase voter registration databases, bring down power grids, transportation infrastructure, or something else to interfere with actual voting on election day. We already know that the Russians tried to become and did become involved in hacking the DNC, who knows, and trying to hack into state systems. What reassurances do we have? That's a pretty major thing that it seems to me isn't in fantasy land anymore, that indeed, unless something is done, that could happen. So the sanctity of our vote, of our democracy, could be in jeopardy. That's huge.
It is. It is. And in some ways, lost the wrong word, because that would sort of imply that the scandal is not real, but obscured by the enormity of the Trump-Russia scandal, the collusion scandal, is that the policy didn't change.
So right, right.
You can imagine like an alternate universe where Donald Trump came in, still didn't believe that Russia really did anything, didn't want to have his presidency questioned, but at the same time took what President Obama said seriously, took what state election officials, including Republicans, have said seriously, and decided to really hammer Russia based on what we know that it did. But he's not doing any of that. So if you're Russia right now, you haven't gotten things that you thought you might get. So sanctions haven't been lifted. You haven't had the invasion of Ukraine recognized. You haven't had Syria being handed to you on a silver platter. But what you have had is, as a country, we're now questioning ourselves more
yes.
than at any point in history. You know, your caller's question a moment ago, if you're Vladimir Putin listening to this radio show in Moscow, you're just giggling and giggling and giggling. I mean, you now have Americans wondering if their votes matter, if their votes count, if the system can hold, if our Constitution can hold. And this is all because of Donald Trump, and to a degree it's all because of the things that you did on the margins that may have helped him win.
Mm.
And that's kind of remarkable. And to your point, which I agree with completely, right now he has paid no price for that whatsoever. I mean, absolutely none. I think when history looks back at this, it will judge Barack Obama very harshly for not having done more himself to both publicize what Russia was doing and to punish Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, the small punishment Barack Obama did, Donald Trump has done absolutely nothing.
Let's go next to, thanks, Nell, for, excuse me, your call, Lynn in Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Kathleen, and I will sorely miss you.
Thank you, Lynn. I'll miss you, too.
This is so a la Goebbels with the, if you say it loud enough and long enough, it becomes truth. We need to trust our media. It's the foundation of, one of the foundations of our democracy. And the constant drumming of fake news, fake, poor me, they're all against me, and you know, and I love you all you. He said he loved the undereducated, and that didn't resonate with any of them. And what can we do? That's a huge question. I'm sorry.
That's fine, Lynn.
It is, and it's a very depressing one. If you're someone who's sitting like people at NPR, like people here at Fox, like people in Washington, if you're the people who are trying to make sense of all this, it's a very depressing question because it's worked. You know, the constant barrage of fake news, like even just that phrase. So it isn't simply that he's questioned and gotten people to question the truth of the news, is that he's kind of coined a phrase, like in the same way he coined "you're fired," and that became something people just said. Fake news is a phrase people just say all the time. It's just like shorthand for liberal media. And he's managed to do that. He's managed to use phrases like alternative facts. And he has his press people go out and just say things that are verifiably untrue, but just say them again and again and again. I have a colleague who spent a bit of the time in the run-up to November 8th retweeting things she had tweeted out 4 years ago during the Obama-Romney campaign. And it was literally enough to make you just start sobbing at your desk because 4 years ago, it would be things like, you know, Obama, Romney wrestle over the details of some obscure bill, or they're wrestling over Obamacare. But, like, these are brilliant, respectful, successful men who are fighting on policy for the most part. And, frankly, the country would have been fine, right? President Romney would have been a fine president. President Obama was a fine president. Depending on your politics, you'd prefer one to the other. But if President Romney had been in office, we wouldn't be thinking, oh, my God, is American democracy about to collapse? He was a decent, fine person, as was President Obama. But you compare it to what we're debating now. We're debating whether fact exists, whether there's such a thing as objective truth.
Right.
And it dates back, if you think back even just to day one, the Trump inaugural crowd is tiny. Sean Spicer's debut on the White House podium as press secretary is to go out and lie and to say that it was bigger than Obama's when that's easily verifiably untrue.
Hmm.
But they're doing the two simultaneously. They're labeling what is true fake, and they're doing what's fake as true. And I'm always hesitant to liken anything to the Nazis, ever. And I don't want to say this is Goebbels, this is Hitler, this is whatever comparison you want to make. All of that said, it is very scary to watch how effectively you can use propaganda in the United States. I think we always thought of ourselves as different, and we're seeing here that we're not.
Mm. Let's go back to President Obama for a moment, and I'm interested in why he didn't give us the information that he knew. Why didn't he just hold a press conference, a national press conference, you know, behind the desk in the Oval Office or wherever? He's a good speaker, and let Americans know what he knew about Russian involvement in the election. Why didn't he do that?
I think that that's the question that his own aides are asking right now, and I think that's one of the questions history will ask of him and about him for many, many, many years to come. His argument then, publicly and privately, was, if I do that, I'm going to call more attention to it, and I'm going to make it seem like I'm trying to help Hillary Clinton win the election. And then if she wins, she'll be seen as illegitimate. And bear in mind, this was also a time where in the entire world, including Donald Trump, thought he was going to lose. And so if you're Barack Obama, your calculus was, Hillary's going to win anyway. If I say this, people are going to accuse me of politicizing mm-hmm. the election. If it'll raise question about whether she's a legitimate winner. She's already got this thing won, so why bother? But I think he's going to be judged very, very harshly for having made both an obvious mistake when it came to Hillary's chances, but a deeper mistake of, and it's kind of heartbreaking. I mean, he was trusting in the goodness of the American people and in the integrity of the members of Congress that he shared this information with, and those were mistakes, it turned out.
Mm. Lynn, thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Mike in Milwaukee, hello.
Hello, I'm sorry to hear you're going too. I just heard this from a couple comments.
Oh.
I hope you I doubt that they're going to find a good replacement for you, Kathleen.
Oh, they'll find somebody. I hope they will.
You're an icon, I'm telling you.
No, thank you, Mike.
I just want to remind people of a couple things here. There was he was just talking about propaganda. William Poindexter, a five-time felon where he lied to Congress, was the Bush administration wanted to hire him to propagandize to the United States, and I guess it's unconstitutional to do that to your own citizens. And Operation Mockingbird, which was a CIA endeavor to infiltrate the media and have their own people and to have other reporters reporting the CIA spins of things. And if you think it's a conspiracy, check the congressional record. There was some people walked away with some hefty fines because of that, and they didn't investigate it all the way, I think, because they were afraid of what else they were going to find. President Eisenhower was trying to have detente with the Russians, and the CIA behind his back undid that. And when he gave his farewell speech, the big part of the speech was, beware of the military-industrial complex. You're going to lose your democracy. And John F. Kennedy found out that the CIA was trying to undo what he was, as a president, what he was trying to do in the Bay of Pigs. And he fired Alan Dulles and threatened and started to break up the CIA. And we know how that happened.
So bring us up to now, Mike. Bring us up to now.
Well, my point is that if you remember, everybody's forgotten this, including the guests, is that just a few months ago, somebody hacked the CIA, and they exposed the codes that the CIA had. And one of the important ones that they were afraid of was it was a CIA code that they developed with the NSA to be able to hack somebody else's system and make it look like somebody else did it. And I'm just saying there's so much history in the hatred for the CIA and the love of the Cold War that we need a war with Russia ongoing constantly.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Well, let's add another layer to all of this. Yogi, what do you say?
To be totally honest, I didn't entirely understand the caller's point.
That the CIA actually
yeah,
was...
No, I heard what he said. I just didn't fully grasp it, in part because the things that were stolen, the code that was posted was the NSA. That was not the CIA. It was stolen from the NSA, not from the CIA. So just as a factual matter, that was a bit off. But the fact that you've had tensions between the White House, many White Houses, and many presidents in the CIA is, of course, nothing new. And there's always been that scandal about – scandal is the wrong word – but the sort of conspiracy theory that the CIA helped kill John F. Kennedy. So, yes, this is nothing new. What's new here in some ways is how public it is. I mean, that's in some ways – what is most remarkable about the entire Trump presidency. I had a diplomat from one of the Arab countries say to me that in the recent past, his government and other governments around the world spend hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars trying to figure out what a president was thinking. You know, like, is Barack Obama angry at Saudi Arabia? Or is Barack Obama angry at Russia? And what's he angry about? Is he in a good mood? Is he in a bad mood? But this was something that their spies focused on the most. And now in the age of Donald Trump, there's no need to do any of that because he tweets out what he's thinking about, and he tweets out if he's happy or if he's sad. And you see the same thing with the CIA. You've had previous presidents hate the CIA and fight the CIA, but it was usually done quietly. With Donald Trump, he gives a press conference in Poland, of all places, and starts bashing the CIA and making fun of them at a press conference, or bashing them on Twitter and comparing them to Nazis. And that's what's new here. What's new is how public this all is.
Before we go back to phone calls, the news that broke over the weekend that there was another person in the room, and tell me what you know about him. I can't remember his name, but he was a cybersecurity guy. He was involved in the Russian war in Afghanistan in some way. Who was this guy, and is it troublesome that he was in the room at the Donald Trump Jr. meeting?
I think it adds even more to this question of should they have not at any point stopped and asked themselves, wait a second, who are these people? And wait a second, what is it that they want from us? What are they trying to bring to us? And the person in question is somebody who has a background and ties to Russian intelligence and is seen as somebody who, in the past, might have had connections to the Soviet Union. He was there. His name is, let me call it open because I wrote it down because I knew I'd forget it.
Thank you for writing it down.
Yeah, it's a hard one to pronounce, but yes. It's Rinat Akhmetsin, mm-hmm. who is thought to have been a Soviet intelligence operative. he is someone who has been involved in a sort of paramilitary capacity over the years. It is also worth pointing out that it isn't as if, like, a Russian spy bearing a machine gun walked into Trump Tower. You know, this is somebody who plausibly now is a business person and plausibly is not someone who has, like, a giant blaring alarm bell over him. But it is true that coming into this meeting with a lawyer who herself is seen as a Russian envoy, whose husband is a member of the Putin cabinet, until recently, I should say, had been a member of the Putin cabinet, who is known for being close to Putin, when she brings with her somebody who is also known to be close to Putin and was also a former intelligence operative, it gets kind of weird. And, you know, we've spoken to people at Vox as part of some of the interviews we've done who are former intelligence operatives who say, if you were trying to recruit somebody in a campaign, this is exactly how you would do it. You would send somebody who was not a Russian government official, who was not somebody who came with a thick Russian accent. You would send somebody who had lived in the U.S. and spoke perfect English, who was a lawyer and a well-regarded lawyer, who would sort of subtly say that they had information that might help, but that if you were trying to recruit an agent, this is how you would do it. And that's really terrifying.
I guess you have your next headline. The whole thing is getting kind of weird.
Exactly.
Yeah. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Good afternoon, and thanks, and we're all going to miss you, Kathleen.
Thanks, Rich.
I'd like your guest's reaction to my reaction to the stuff that's going on. I'm old. I was a youngster when I watched the House on American Activities Committee hearings, and I recall my parents discussing them and that sort of thing. To me, the parallel is not to fascism or Hitlerism or Nazism. It's almost as though our own state Senator Joseph McCarthy and his sidekick Roy Cohn won an election, and the only difference now is that they hold the executive branch and the rest of us are watching this going on. I recall a year, well, 18 months ago, I was going to say a year ago, Donald Trump said something remarkable in the heat of a campaign where he said, laughing, "You know, folks, I could stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot people." He was claiming he could be a murderer, and I wouldn't lose any voters. And I think we're now kind of at the cusp where, as Americans, we're really going to decide whether any man who thinks in terms of being the boss rather than as a public servant in a system of checks and balances actually gets to behave that way, as though he's in a boardroom somewhere where he cannot be questioned, as opposed to he's in a Democratic, Republican, representative form of government where he has to answer to people for what he says.
Yeah, I think the caller makes a great point, and I also, you know, kudos to a person who's had the ability to live and witness the best of American history and obviously some of the worst parts of it, but there's, I think, a fair question, and I really don't mean this to sound glib, although I'm sure that it will, about whether Donald Trump has ever read the Constitution. And I'm not convinced that he has. And again, I know that will sound very glib, and I wish there was a way to say it in a way that it didn't, but there were photos released recently of, they were in the National Archive, they had been archived and were only made public about 2 weeks ago, of the Bush administration in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. So they're the famous photos of George Bush reading the book to the children, then he gets whispered into his ear and goes pale. We've all seen that photo. But these are the photos of what happened next. And there's a huge part of America that would argue that George W. Bush was a disastrous president, a failed president, a catastrophic president. But and look at those photos, I thought to myself that at the very least, this was a president whose staff and him were, for the most part, honorable people. For the most part, people who had read the Constitution, who knew the Constitution, who were patriots in their own way. Again, regardless of the many catastrophic mistakes they made. With Donald Trump, I'm not at all sure he's ever read the Constitution. I'm not sure if you said to him, if you quizzed him on what was in it, that he would know the answers. And I agree with your caller that what's somewhat most jarring here is that there are limits on his power that I don't think that he knew existed. Other presidents discovered there were limits that they didn't know existed. The difference is those presidents accepted that that was a reality and tried to work around it. Donald Trump does not appear to accept that that's a valid constraint. And that, I think, to your one of your earlier callers who were questioning, is this kind of a low point for American democracy. The fact that he's questioning basic institutions is unique. and uniquely damaging. And again, I don't think we're at the point of saying this is the worst moment since the Civil War, but if you're looking for evidence that points you kind of in that same gradual direction, it's that that I would point to.
Thank you, Rich, so much for your call. Neil in Slinger, hi.
Hi. Going to miss you.
Thanks, Neil.
What would happen if Donald Trump goes against the possible foreign entities, including Russia, that support him? Would he be punished, i.e. assassinated? Thank you.
Wow. That's a very hard and very grim question to answer. And I don't want to kind of touch the question of whether he'll be assassinated. I mean, he's the president of the United States, and I think any act of violence against him or his family would be horrific on a personal and a human and a political level. So I'll just ignore that one if I could.
Yeah, but it does point to how ruthless this Russian state can be, and people just they're not accepting that. Journalists disappearing and people dying in jail and people being murdered. I mean, it's a part of the whole Russian government apparatus now, and for some reason we're just not looking at it. It's weird, isn't it?
It is, and I think what's striking is that we are all looking at it. I mean, I think if you were to ask the average American, even the average Republican, hey, would you want to live in Russia? Almost nobody would say yes. You know, you would find people, I think, who would say, well, no, but at least they've got a strong leader and a strong president. But if you ask people, do you actually want to be a citizen of that country as compared to a citizen of the United States, this is not something where people are going to be raising their hands to try to run and get a Russian passport. But it is all the same very striking that Donald Trump, and in some ways he's the one who matters most in this discussion, he doesn't recognize what Vladimir Putin is and what his government is. If you remember, there was a really revealing and horrifying the moment, even more horrifying looking back at it, exchange he had with Bill O'Reilly. And Bill O'Reilly, to his credit, very accurately and aggressively pressing Donald Trump about Putin and saying, this man's a killer, was Bill O'Reilly's exact phrase, and saying, he kills journalists, he kills political opponents. Right. Why are you so warm about him? And Trump's response was, who are we to judge? You know, do you think we're not also killers?
Mm-hmm.
And for decades, Democrats were always accused of Republicans, sorry, we're accused by Republicans, excuse me, of making moral equivalencies and saying the U.S. is also sin, so therefore the U.S. can't criticize blank, or the U.S. shouldn't lecture the world on blank. But imagine if a Democrat had said that. I mean, imagine if Barack Obama, during the campaign, before he was reelected, but during the campaign, went on national television and said, we're no better than Russia. He would have been strung up. You know, that would have been the end of his campaign. This would have been the end of the Obama presidency. He would have been, his poll numbers would have plummeted. People would say he's a decent man and a good man, but he's not fit to hold the office of the presidency, and that would be it. Donald Trump openly says that he loves Vladimir Putin, that he sees Putin as a stronger and better leader than the actual president, than Barack Obama, and then goes further and says that we as a country are no different or better, and he as a presidential candidate, Obama as an actual president, are no better than a murderous thug like Vladimir Putin and pays no price whatsoever.
Oh, it is getting kind of weird, isn't it? That's the subject of the hour. Our guest is Yoki Driesen, and we're getting up to date on what's going on with Russia and the Trump campaign and Putin and Trump and why some people believe it's nothing and others are vitally concerned, seeing it really is a test of our democracy right now. I don't know if any of the rest of you are worried about the elections in 2018, but it's striking to me that there don't seem to be any assurances that our elections will be held secure. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR. Our wonderful guest is a foreign editor at Vox. He has worked for Foreign Policy Magazine and for the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War, which is the story of a military family who lost two sons, one to suicide and one to combat. Yoki has been in Iraq and Afghanistan, made 30 trips there, and has spent 5 years on the ground in those countries. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network. B in Milwaukee, our next caller, Yoki. Hi, B. Hello, B. Oh, I don't know what happened to you. All right, let's go to Marson in La Crosse. Hi, Marson.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. Hey, congratulations on your retirement.
Thank you.
My concern is that I think Donald Trump Jr. and those who would support him for taking that meeting really need to think about their priorities. I know the old saying is the enemy of my enemy is my friend, but at the point where you begin to consider the opposing American political party such an enemy that you're willing to go to an actual foreign power who is a historic enemy of the country seeking damaging information, I think that's a line that is not good to cross.
Yoki?
I think that's right. I mean, it's easy to imagine a scenario. Again, nothing would have to change except for a tweak to the Trump Jr. response, where the exact same thing happens. Russia decides they want to help Donald Trump. Russia decides that they are in some way going to hack emails and figure out some way to release them publicly. Russia decides they're going to send an envoy to the Trump campaign to openly say, we have stuff that can help you. It's part of a broad effort to help you. So all of that is exactly the same. And the only thing that changes is that the email goes to Donald Trump Jr., and Donald Trump Jr. pauses and says to himself, this is Russia. Is this legal? And that's it. That's the one change. Instead of responding back instantaneously that he wants to do it, instead of responding by bringing in Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort, all he does is the basic human decency as a politician or as a human being, as an American, is saying, hang on a second, Russia just told me they're trying to interfere in our election, and they want to help my father win by basically cheating. What do I do? And there was a case, and this was now feels like a different lifetime and a different planet, but in the 2000 campaign, the Gore campaign was sent a briefing book that somebody had stolen from the Bush campaign that basically laid out the way Bush was preparing for one of the debates. And Gore took that, told the Gore staffers didn't look at it. They kept it closed, and they alerted the FBI and sent it back to George W. Bush. And that seems so quaint. And that was only 17 years ago. I mean, in the kind of historical sweep of things, that was not that long back. But that was Al Gore getting something from George W. Bush. This was one American politician getting from another American politician and deciding, that's cheating. That goes too far. I won't do it. Here you have a hostile foreign power intervening and an American party saying, not only am I not going to say no to it, I'm going to enthusiastically say yes to it. And that really is, you know, again, to me, looking at it from the outside, that's the most depressing part, that he was so enthusiastic about accepting it.
He didn't do the honorable thing. The word is
absent. He didn't do the honorable thing or even, frankly, just the self-protective thing even. I mean, what's so amazing about these emails in some ways is it's almost as if Donald Trump Jr. were thinking to himself, okay, how do I make the most incriminating case possible? Like, what has to be in the email for me to look the absolute worst? And then he says, okay, what has to be in there was some Russian saying, I'm coming to you with stuff about Hillary. Check. And it has to say that it's part of a broad Russian support for your dad. Check. And a broad Russian campaign to help your dad in all kinds of ways. Check. And then once I get all of that, I have to respond by saying, hell yes, I want that. Mm-hmm. Check. And then I also need to bring in as many other senior members of the campaign as I can. So it's like he really was intentionally trying to make this as damaging to himself as he could. Did it and didn't think twice about it.
Here's an email from Georgine. Trump appears to be the type of man who's in the loop about everything. Who or what has the power to intervene and protect the security of this country, and why hasn't Kushner's security clearance been halted?
So that's a great question. I mean, the security clearance comes from, in the case of a White House staffer, it basically comes from the White House itself. So the one person who could really make the decision on whether to strip it is Donald Trump. So far, you have calls from Republicans and Democrats to strip it away. So far, at least, Donald Trump is refusing to do that.
And, oh, I guess we don't have time to take one more phone call. I'm sorry, we have many people on the line. Let me just say to the audience, if you can go to Facebook, if you have access to that, please leave your comments there so we can read them. I don't want to miss all of your comments. Yoki, are there more emails out there? Where do you think the press is looking for information now?
I think the big question, of course, is how much of this did Trump know? And I think the other part of this is, in the initial email to Donald Trump Jr., there was a sort of cryptic reference to other things that Russia is trying to do to help, mm-hmm. other ways it's trying to manifest its support. And that's a giant question. You know, what were those other things? What were those other ways? And the emails don't make that clear. And that's, to my mind, the other big question.
Thank you ever so much for being with us. You were just a very informative guest. I feel like I've been listening to a John le Carré novel. No, I mean, really. But it's not.
Sure.
It's real. Yoki, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care.
Yoki Driesen, foreign editor now at Vox, author of The Invisible Front, Love and Loss in an Era of Endless War. Thanks very much for all of your calls. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour, and to thanks Colleen as well for on-air work here in Milwaukee. For all of your calls, thank you very much. My retirement has been mentioned. I'll be around a little while longer, till August 10th, so we'll have some good shows for you before then. I promise. Thanks for listening. News is coming up in just a few moments.